What's going to come up tonight, of course, Joseph's going to get sold into slavery. There's 12 brothers. Benjamin does not play part of this story, so there's 11 brothers. Benjamin is apparently real young. So there's going to be 10 brothers that are going to be mentioned as far as a group. But Reuben and Judah are going to be dominant in this story. Now, they're going to continue throughout the rest of this book. Reuben is the firstborn, but he lost his privilege because he slept with one of Jacob's wives, concubines, probably in an attempt, not in a sexual sin, but in a rebellion sin as far as trying to take authority. I mean, it was sexual corruption, but he was using sex or Jacob's wife to claim leadership early, because their leadership should come to him. And then he is going to be discredited. In this story, you're going to see him try to save Joseph. So possibly that attempt to save Joseph is, there may be some good morality to it. He may have realized the importance of not shedding innocent blood, which is going to come up. But he also is hoping maybe he can separate himself and be the chosen. Another thing before we mention Judah, throughout this story, and you're going to, the way it's written, and even a couple commentators mentioned this, is like it. You've got the story, and you don't know what the narrative's viewpoint or the narrator's viewpoint is. Like, is Joseph like the perfect son? And I've heard it taught before, and I think I may have mentioned it myself, but I've heard some people teach it. Besides Jesus, Joseph is the only character in the Bible with no flaws. And again, you can read it that way because he gets persecuted, sold, and rises up. He has sexual integrity with Potiphar's wife, and he ends up restoring the family, a very good young man, an old man eventually. But then there's some things that are mentioned. It's kind of like, well, that Joseph, what are you doing? I mean, you're not real smart, or you're a little presumptuous, or he seems, and he tells the story. He tells like the cupbearer in the prison. He says, I was stolen from my homeland. And earlier he said, I was sold to someone else. But when it comes time to tell the story, he doesn't want to say, well, I was sold here as a slave. Well, that's going to have some questions. It'd be better like I was kidnapped. I was just taken and forcibly brought here. So it's like he doesn't leave any room. So it's like he kind of pads the story. So you got to wonder here about Joseph. First of all, he's young and he's got room to grow since he's a young man. But you got to be careful to just paint him off as this perfect man. But again, we don't want, he's not painted as a negative man. He's painted as a typical young man who has issues, who's going to grow and mature. And the same is true with all these guys. I think we can see room for growth in Reuben's character, in Judah's character. When it comes time tonight, Judah's going to be the one who decides that we should sell him so we don't shed innocent blood. And he's going to sell Joseph. And he's going to then continue throughout the story. Next week in chapter 38, we're going to have the whole stories about Reuben, or excuse me, about Judah and a failure. But at the end of the chapter, he's going to have a long speech confessing his error, confessing his sin, and claiming to be unrighteous or less unrighteous as other people. And so Judah's in a process of growth until, remember that how the story ends, Joseph asks for Benjamin to be brought. Then he sets up the stage. He manipulates the whole situation so it looks like Benjamin stole the silver cup. So Joseph's manipulating situations. And why? Is he trying to restore the family? Is he trying to make his second dream come full, you know, be fulfilled? But then Benjamin is going to be taken as a slave by Joseph, as he's pretending. And Judah's going to be the one that steps up and says, no, don't take him, take me. So Judah's going to have some serious, and again, these are not young people. By this time, these guys are 50, 60, 70 years old. These are men with grandchildren. And so these are quite a group of men, and you're going to see them grow. But nonetheless, Reuben and Judah are going to be prominent in tonight's story and throughout. The other 10 are not mentioned except that they are involved. So let's get started. I'm going to read the first four verses or so, and then we'll come back and make some points and talk about this. There's so many things in this story, and once again, the reason there is because the story is being told, but it's not over-narrated. It's just kind of told, and then it's, well, what's going on? And you got these possible scenarios. Who's the hero? And really, what it comes down to is just a situation in a normal person's life that God is leading. Another thing I'll mention before we start, in this chapter, in Abraham's life, you had theophanies. God appears to him. We know. He talked with him. He ate with him. The Lord appeared to Abraham. Not just the spiritual vision, but, physically. Isaac, the Lord appeared and spoke with Isaac. The Lord appeared a couple of times to Jacob, even sent him away after appearing to him, came at the bottom of the stairway and spoke with him, and then says, come back to see me here. And Jacob came again, and the Lord appeared to him a second time at Bethel, not to mention the time he saw him over in by Peniel, by the Jabbok River. So Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob have all seen the Lord face to face. Here, there's really no encounter. God is going to speak to Jacob before he goes down to Egypt. He's going to tell him it later on in another chapter, it's okay to go to Egypt, because he told Isaac, you can't leave. I remember Abraham was in and out of the land. Jacob is in and out of the land, but Isaac was born in the land, stayed in the land, never left the land, and God told him not to. So God is going to appear one more time to Jacob and tell him it's okay to go. But otherwise, Joseph's going to have dreams. He's going to interpret dreams. He's going to say God is the master of all the dreams, but Joseph is not going to have a theophany. Joseph is not going to see God face to face. God is going to, in a sense, step back behind the curtain and let things play out as he prophesied to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And now, again, he's still involved. He's just not, again, I don't know what that means. It's just, you can clearly see Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob having an encounter with God face to face, eating meals with him, talking to him, wrestling with him physically. But Joseph, there's the fear of God, there's the knowledge of God, but there's, God doesn't even come and talk to him in a dream. Joseph has dreams, and he credits them to God, but it's a difference. It's like God stepped back behind the curtain, if you would. He's still involved, but letting things play out. So that's something to look at as we go through. Nonetheless, chapter 37, verse 1. Jacob lived in the land of his father's sojournings, in the land of Canaan. Okay, that just says that's where he's at, where they sojourned, they came here and lived, and he's back in the land, happily living in the land promised to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And then, of course, the Toledot. These are the generations of Jacob. These are the Toledot of Jacob, the story, the documents, the record of Jacob. And I think most of the commentators struggle with this because the Toledot of Jacob, and then we talk about Joseph. Well, no. This is the generations of Jacob. This is Jacob and what he was overseeing, because the next chapter is not about Joseph. The next chapter is about Judah. And it's all about the brothers and what's taking place in Jacob's family. Just like it says, this is the Toledot of Isaac. And then we had the account of Jacob, his two sons, Jacob and Esau. So that sometimes people say, well, it says this is the story of Jacob, but for some reason, we all talk about Joseph. We're not talking about Joseph. Joseph is in the story here, but this is about life that Jacob lived. This is what took place during his time. So these are the Toledot of Jacob. Joseph, being 17 years old, so now you know how old he is, and we know that he's going to have a couple years at Potiphar's house. He's going to be the 7 years of plenty, the 7 years of famine. So you got 14, 16 years, add that to 17. We kind of know how old he is when he meets his brothers. And he can kind of work with that on, how he was probably under 10 years old when Rachel, his mom, died. And Benjamin, of course, is younger than Joseph. Maybe Benjamin at this time, he's not even in the story. What is he, 10, 12 years old himself? Joseph, being a 17-year-old, was pasturing the flock with his brothers. Again, that's the Hebrew translation, so it gives the impression that he's out in the fields with his brothers, but as the story goes, we find out he's not. He's with his father, almost like a supervisor checking on his brothers. And that's kind of going to cause some problems. Again, these brothers are not, if he's 17, you can imagine his brothers are, you know, 25 to 35, almost 40 years old. He was a boy with the brothers. He was a boy with the sons of Bilhah and Zilpah, his father's wives. Again, a lot of things happened there, right there. Where is Leah's name? Leah's not mentioned. Maybe she has died. It's not recorded, but that could be. Bilhah and Zilpah, and they're called wives. So they've moved into the rank of not just a concubine, not just with Rachel and Leah, but they're the wives. And all the sons are given credit for that. So this could be Bilhah could have become, with Rachel's death, Bilhah could have become Jacob's, or excuse me, be careful if I say Jacob and Joseph, I exchange those names. I've been in a habit the last few weeks of getting names. I said on Sunday three times in a row that Paul was persecuting Christians in the Colosseum. Did you hear that? I heard that on the videotape, and I was able to cut that part. I said it three times, and I said it again, and then I said it again. And so it was like a 15-second, 20-second run. I could cut it and splice it together, and I got rid of it. So only people that heard me say Paul was persecuting Christians in the Colosseum three times was everybody that was there or online. But otherwise, I cleaned it up. So anyway, Jacob and Joseph are two separate people. Their names may be used interchangeably tonight, not unintentionally. He was a boy. Joseph was a boy with the sons of Bilhah and Zilpah. And again, I'm not sure if that means anything, that he was a boy with these men who had slaughtered the city of Shechem. Remember, they'd killed an entire city, or at least Levi and Simeon had. His father's wives. And Joseph brought a bad report of them to their father. And this could be, again, this can be seen in a couple of ways. This could be Joseph's first sin, because that's the same word used when the spies brought a negative report back to Moses, or back to the people about the land. Moses sent out the 12 spies. 10 of them came back with an evil report. Oh, no. And they lied about it, and they exaggerated how big the giants were. We'll never be able to do it, and discouraged all the people. So they were a bad report. It was a lie. It was deception. It was to manipulate people. So does Joseph bring that kind of need? Was he manipulating his father more? Did he have his dad in a corner? He was his favorite son. I'm going to tell you more bad things about my brothers and continue to elevate myself. It could mean that, or it could mean, which is not hard to believe, these 10 boys were like not behaving well. They were eating the sheep instead of taking care of them. They were trading the sheep for favors in other areas of the country. We're going to find out. They're some 65 miles away, and they've gone back up to Shechem with the sheep. Again, we'll talk about that in a minute. What are you doing in Shechem? I mean, you fled Shechem. Now you're up there pasturing your flocks around Shechem where you killed everybody. Typically, Joseph brought a report, an honest report about the bad behavior of his brothers to tell his father, man, I don't know what we're going to do with these guys. So that could be, you could go either way with that. It could be Joseph is manipulating his father, exaggerating his brother's behavior, or he's actually saying, my gosh, Dad, I'm not sure how we're going to make any money this year. The boys aren't taking care of it. Now, Israel, or Jacob, loved Joseph more than any other of his sons. Okay, there it is. He loved him more. That's nice, love, but it doesn't say he saw, it could mean this, he saw Joseph with great leadership potential, and so he put him in a special school for leaders to take over the family business. That would be one. He saw the potential. This is more like he loved him. He's my favorite. It's again, more negative. So I think it's justified as we see Joseph develop, but this is not Jacob making a good decision. He loved Joseph more than any of the other of his sons. And this is also confusing, because he was the son of his old age. Okay, but you've still got Benjamin, who was younger. So that is the son of your really old age then. Now, does he have a hard feelings towards Benjamin because Benjamin came about and killed his wife in his birth process? He's going to favor Benjamin later, won't send him to Egypt. So it doesn't seem like that's the case, but why is that said? Because it's like a strange statement. And once again, is this the narrator's view? Or it could be read this way, and some commentators and Hebrew people will say this, Joseph, more than any other of his sons, because he was a son of old age. He was a mature son. He's 17 years old, but this kid has got his head on straight. Most people don't go that way because obviously it's translated this way. But if you struggle with, well, he's not the youngest son, but nonetheless, that's the reason the narrator says he favored Joseph more because he was a son of his old age. And again, the son of his favorite wife. And he made him a robe of many colors. Okay, again, this most definitely made him a robe of many colors is, and robes, clothing were used for this, is to distinguish him from the other people. You've got these people here and they dress like this, but this person dresses, we do it, in all cultures do it. This person dresses special because they are special. They're the leader. They've got special rights. They're the priest. They're the king. They're the, you know, the boss. They own the company. And then people try and do that in their own lives. They try and buy things to make them look, you know, distinguished. So this definitely means that. And robe, if you look in the footnotes, not the footnotes, but the notes, I've got two Greek or Hebrew boxes there. The first one is for verse 2. And I've got the phrase right there for report of them. That means defaming, evil report, infamy, slander. And then the word bad that's translated there from the Hebrew, from the word ra, it means bad or evil nature or evil morally. So that could be a morally evil report. But it also could be slander. You know, slander. He's not doing it for a benefit. He's doing it to slander. Kind of like the spies. It was slander. I tend to read it that there's something morally going wrong. And it was a report of evil moral behavior that was, you know, defaming them or an evil report. So that's those two words there. And that's what we're working with. But now you come down here in the next box, verse 4, verse 3. Now Israel loved Joseph more than any other of his sons because he was the son of his old age, and he made him a robe of many colors. That is the English Standard Translation. Now, first of all, the phrase robe is in that the first box. It's the first box on the right. It's translated robe in your Greek box. It's from an unused root meaning to cover. I mean, it's the root word, but it's not used in the Bible. It means to cover. And there it's pronounced kathonath. And it means coat, long robe, or tunic. And that's pretty solid. It's a long robe. It's a tunic. It's something he wrapped around. And it's something the other boys don't have. So that would mean it's some kind of distinguishing feature. And probably not from Jacob's own idea. You don't see people, unless God is giving a directive, like this is what you will do. This is what the world does, but this is how you will do it. You see God doing that. But when someone like an Israelite or some person in the Bible does something to like show symbolism, it's something that comes out of their culture. Just like we would do something, it wouldn't mean anything to our culture if we're the only ones that knew what it meant. So this means something to Jacob and his culture by giving Joseph this coat. It's not God ordained. It's not a message from God. It's not symbolism from God, like from the tabernacle or the temple. It's something that means something in the culture, so we should be able to find images of this other places, but it distinguishes Joseph. Now it's a robe, and now in the English Standard, there's the word P-A-S-S-I-M, pasim, and that's plural, but it's the word from pas, P-A-S, you can see it there, I've got to the left side, and it occurs here, and then in 2 Samuel, I'll show you 2 Samuel here in just a minute, it's Tamar, David's daughter's coat, is the same thing as this. Where you and I get the multicolored robe from is the Greek Septuagint. And the Greek Septuagint represented, here, I've got this written on the board there. This is about 1898 BC, this is taking place. right here, this year, about 1898. But what was I saying? You gotta drop the eraser. What's that?
The Greek
Septuagint. Oh, thank you. See, it's going, folks. Don't laugh, because you know exactly what I mean. That's why you laugh. It's like, okay, so the Greek Septuagint translated around 200 BC. So it took the Hebrew, the available Hebrew text in 200 BC, we're talking 2,200 years ago. They take the Hebrew text, and the Greeks, Ptolemy and these people, wanted the Hebrew scriptures in Greek. So they took the Hebrew scriptures and translated it into Greek for about 200 BC, 200 years before Christ. Paul and the apostles sometimes quote from this is the word seven, the letter 70, because supposedly 70 Hebrew scribes translated the Hebrew into Greek. Again, a lot of that, we don't know if that's true or not, but it's called the 70 or the 70 Septuagint. It says Septuagint, but this is the symbol for it. There, this word right here that I've got in the square, pas or pasim, they translated it as multicolored. Now, no one knows how they got that. It's like, what? And so this is something that is useful, but with this, the word itself, what do we do with it? We're not sure what this word means, but around 78 or 200 BC, that's what they called it. So it's the Greek translation of this word in 200 BC, but as far as what the word means, we're struggling. So some people have bailed out of this multicolored. English Standard Version, which is a recent translation, hasn't given up on it. And that is where I've got right there, the third point there, this LXX, is multicolored frock. Post-biblical, like after the Bible was completed, the word pas, P-A-S, began to mean flat of the hand, the palm, and flat of the foot or sole. Now this is where more scholars, you know, obviously it didn't hit the English Standard Version, and no Bibles say it this way, translations, but as they're looking at it, the word pas that we're wondering about right here, that was translated multicolored in 200 BC into Greek, and that's solid, we know that. But as we look at it, or as scholars look at this, the word pas, it looks like it refers to the flat part of the palm or the sole of the foot. So it was a coat, they say, a long sleeve coat that extended to the hands and extended to the ankles. And so it's a long sleeve, long tunic. That's going on. I'm just giving you information. Ezekiel 47:3 uses a pes to refer to the ankles or the end extremities of the water that came up to Ezekiel uses the word, and the waters came up to a pass to his ankles. So if you take that and read this back, this was a coat that went to the extremities. So that is what we've got there in the Hebrew. I'm just showing you that. If you turn the page, since we're talking about it, turn the page. This is 2 Samuel where the word is used again. Now, my friends, it's the same thing, except it doesn't have the Septuagint translating it. 2 Samuel 13, 18, and 19. This is talking about David's daughter, Tamar. Now, she was wearing a long robe with sleeves. I got it under. That's the same thing. For thus were the virgin daughters of the king dressed. So, in other words, the virgin daughters of the king, how do you know that's a virgin daughter of the king? Look what she's wearing. She's got a long dress with sleeves. These people don't. These are the virgin daughters of David. So his servant put her out and bolted the door after her, and Tamar put ashes on her head and tore the long robe that she wore, and she laid on her hand on her head and went away crying aloud as she went. So she goes into mourning. She rips this long robe, which is translated two times. So we go back and we see that Jacob gave Joseph a long robe. Again, I'm not trying to change the Bible story, we're just looking at it. Going down to those pictures, you see those pictures? These are Semitic people. This is from a tomb in Egypt. And these are people that came down, merchants that came down into Egypt around between 1900 and 1800, right here. They're coming down, right here. They're coming down this time period, right here. This is Joseph being sold. These are the 7 years. These are Semitics coming down, and they bring in their products. Then you can see the Egyptians, the way that the Egyptians look. They got the dark skin and the bare upper bodies with the white skirts on. And then the Semitic people, slightly different color skin, but they've got the striped tunics on. And that supports the multicolored idea. Again, the Septuagint didn't make up, I don't know, let's just say it's like a rainbow color. No, it meant multicolored in 200 BC. That's why they translated that way. That's why people are still coming. They were closer to it than we were. Next bullet point, Joseph's garment could have been patches of different colored. And here it's stripes. But there it could be patches of material stitched together. Clothing communicated rank and status. Color, the length, the hem would indicate, like the priests would have special hems on their, not songs, but the hem of the garment would indicate the priesthood. Okay, so that's last bullet point there for sure. Joseph's coat was a full-length coat with long sleeves that may have been some kind of multicolored that they put into there. So nonetheless, the point there is Joseph's got a distinguished garment that separates him from his brothers. What does this mean? It appears he's some kind of overseer, although it began by saying he was pasturing the flock. I go back to this. I'm sorry, I'm going to go back to that. It says he was pasturing the flock with his brothers. In the Hebrew also, the way it's worded, the putting of the words together, it doesn't indicate he was pasturing the flock with his brothers. It could be translated, the same words in the same order could be translated into English. He was pasturing the flock of his brothers. And his father gave him this coat. So he may have been, and it's the same word used when David was the shepherd of the people. You will pasture my people Israel. You will shepherd. It's the same idea. It's just when we look at it, we want to say Joseph was pasturing the flock with his brothers, but he's not doing that. When the story begins, he's not. He's back in Hebron, and his brothers are working the fields. And he's brought a bad report, and then he's sent out to go check on them again. So it doesn't sound like he's pasturing the flock with his brothers. It sounds like he's pasturing his brothers. He's shepherding his brothers. So these are just things that could come out of the text as we put this story together. Okay, is that the end of the text there on that page? Oh yeah, let's go back to chapter, page 1, sorry. Now Israel loved Joseph more than any of his other sons because he was the son of his old age, and he made him a robe of many colors. Nonetheless, that distinguishes, it's got something, he loves him more, he's favoring him. Is he putting him in the place of the birthright? Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and now Joseph? It should be Abraham, Isaac, and Reuben, but he was eliminated. The others, Simeon and Levi, eliminated themselves. Judah's going to cause some problems for himself. Is this the one that he's chosen to inherit the blessing? Remember, God's choosing Abraham. God's choosing Isaac, not Ishmael. He's choosing Jacob, not Esau. Who's choosing the next? Reuben eliminated himself. Judah's not it. Simeon and Levi eliminated themselves. Who's next? Well, remember, there's no theophanies. Maybe Jacob is now just making the decision, and Joseph is going to be the heir of the Abraham and Isaac covenant. Interesting. He does get, like we said, the double portion. When they come back, his two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh, Joseph doesn't become a tribe. There's no tribe of Joseph. There's his two sons become a tribe. So he's got two tribes. He gets the double portion, and they become the nation of northern Israel. Ephraim, they even called Ephraim because they rebel against David's house. So there's a lot of history coming off of this. But when his brothers saw that his father loved him more than all his brothers, again, these are not like high school kids. These are like up to 40-year-old people with families. Loved him more than all of his brothers, they hated him and could not speak peacefully to him. All his interactions with his brother, according to that verse, were not peaceful. They were hostile. He was always justifying himself, so there's this barrier between him and his brothers. Now, that's the only thing we've got about Joseph there is he brought an evil report. Maybe that was good, maybe that was bad, maybe it was slander, maybe it was necessary because he's in charge of this business, maybe he had to do that. I've always given him credit in making a good decision. He's reporting to his father this bad behavior. So that, but there's gonna be ramifications, repercussions for that. Now, here now comes something else. Again, this is not God giving him a theophany, but we do realize that this is God. In their eyes, deity gave dreams. Now, Joseph had a dream. And when he told it to his brothers, they hated him even more. Now, this is going to indicate, one, Jacob knows, one, that he, one, must do it. I had a dream, and it is my responsibility as a prophet of God to tell this vision to my brothers. I must do this. Two, he's, how do you spell the word naive? Is that naive? What? V-E-E? Ignorant. Meaning, it's like, don't say this. I mean, you've all had kids, and they come home from school, they come home from the playground, or they come home from a teacher, and they say, well, and so I said this. It's like, well, that's why you got sent to the office. Yeah, but it was the truth. Yes, we want you to tell the truth, but not like that. And so, yes, Joseph, you had this dream, but you understand your brothers can't speak peacefully to you. Now you're telling them a dream that paints you into a good picture and them into a subservient role. Or three, he knows what he's doing. He knows. This is the truth. Deal with it. So either he feels he must do it because it's the right thing. He's 17 and naive, ignorant. Or he knows it's the truth and I'm the leader and I don't care what you think. Arrogant. So this wouldn't be a fault. Ignorant would be a matter of just growing up. This could be arrogance. So for some reason, his brothers hate him, can't say anything peaceful to him, constant hostility, and he has a dream. Let me tell you what I dreamt last night. Are you done talking? I'll tell you what I dreamt last night. Now, Joseph had a dream, and when he told it to his brothers, they hated him even more. He said to them, hear this dream that I have dreamed. Behold, we were binding sheaves in the field. And behold, my sheaf rose and stood upright. And behold, your sheaves gathered around and bowed down to my sheaf. I'll just tell you what I dreamt last night. We are gathering food. And the food that I gathered, it stood upright. All the food you gathered, it bowed down to my collection of food. Now again, that's going to take place in Egypt. I mean, it's dealing with food, and that's going to take place. But when they heard that, well, what that indicates is we're bowing down. Like Jacob bowed to Esau, you know, eventually, and Esau, you know, received him and respected him. Now Joseph is saying, you're all going to bow down to me. And that's what the idea was, that dreams came from the deity, and dreams were not reversible. This is what's going to happen. Now he's got dad's favor. He's got the coat. He's some kind of an overseer over us. And now he's saying, and guess what? God's just revealed to me that you're going to bow down to me. Eventually, you will be my servants. I'm just telling you what I saw. And, of course, they hated him all the more. And they said to him, his brother said to him, are you indeed to reign over us? Or are you indeed to rule over us? So they hated him even more for his dreams and for his words, for sharing the dreams. Now again, he didn't interpret it for them. Now remember, in Egypt, he's going to be the one who interprets the dreams. Here, he's just having dreams. He doesn't do any interpretation. I'll just tell you what, my sheep was standing right there. All your sheep saw my sheep, and they all bowed down. I don't know what it means. I have no idea what it means. What do you think it means? Well, they knew what it meant. Okay, so that's one. And I guess I would assume Jacob heard it, knew about it, because he hears this next one. So right there, what that means in that dream is he is going to be the ruler of the family. Of all the brothers, he's going to be Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Joseph. Just like Ishmael gave way to Isaac, Esau gave way to Jacob, Reuben and Simeon and Levi are all going to give way to Joseph. Now, that's just in the family. Now, this next dream is not the same dream. Similar, but there's an added factor to it in two ways. Then he dreamed another dream and told it to his brothers and said, "Behold, I have dreamed another dream." Now, again, does he have to say this because he's a prophet and it's required of God, him to, by God, to reveal it? Is he naive? I don't think so. I mean, Jacob has chosen Joseph to be something with the coat. He's overseeing his brothers. He feels free to bring reports to his father. So he must show some sign of maturity, especially when it says, if this way you would interpret it, he was the son of old age for his father. He was a mature son for his father. And it was that Jacob being an old man, or is that Joseph being an old son, mature son? So it's hard to say that he's naive. So does he have to say the dream? I don't see anything in here where it's commanded by God to tell him the dream. I don't think he's naive. Like, man, they all beat me up last time. I'll tell them another dream. See if they beat me up a second. I mean, like, that's how you grow in school. I mean, you all grew up in school somewhere. In first and second grade, you tried something, you got beat up for it or something to that effect. It's like, well, I'm not going to do that again. And your character was developed, or your social skills were polished. I could talk about that for a while. But it doesn't seem to be polishing his social skills. So he shouldn't be, if he was naive for the first dream, he shouldn't be naive here. They hated him all the more and didn't say anything good about him. So now, is he flaunting it? Now again, is this kid arrogant? He doesn't have to say it. I don't think he's ignorant. I think he's possibly flaunting it. I've got the robe. I can write the reports. I'm going to rule over you. Dad says so. My dreams say so. But then he has this dream and drops this dream on him. Behold, I have dreamed another dream. Behold, the sun, the moon, and 11 stars. Behold, the sun, the moon, and 11 stars were bowing down to me. Now, you don't have any other detail. I mean, like, so is he the sun? Wherever, or he doesn't say sun. Well, here's the sun. Here's Joseph. I mean, he's not like a planet. He's just Joseph. But the sun bows down, the moon bows down, and the 11 stars bow down. Well, the 11 stars is pretty clear. Those are his brothers. And that's not new information, because guess what? They bow down as sheaves in the first dream. This right here is additional information, or what we'd say, additional revelation. These dreams apparently do come from God. It's not a theophany, but it does come from God. And this as, well, I'll read it. You know it's here. But when he told it to his father and to his brothers, it wasn't his brothers who rebuked him. His father rebuked him and said to him, "What is this dream that you have dreamed? Shall I and your mother and your brothers indeed come to bow ourselves to the ground before you?" Now, this is not a problem in Jacob's mind right here. The 11 stars bowing down. I mean, that's what Joseph, that's why Joseph's got the coat. They're going to bow down to you. You're going to be the Jacob to the Esau. You're going to be the Isaac to the Ishmael. It's going to be Joseph and the 11 brothers. That's what I'm planning. That's why you got the coat. But Joseph, you're getting out of bounds here. It's Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph. But now you've got, this would be Jacob. Now again, this is going to become a problem. And this would be Rachel, your mother. We are going to bow down to you. This is not just ruling over your generation. This is taking over the family. You're going to take over, the whole genealogy is going to bow down to you. And so Jacob is, how is that going to happen? He says, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob are not going to bow down to you. Also the problem, Rachel is dead. So this could mean, like I said before, Joseph was 10 years old or younger when Rachel died. So Bilhah may have become his stepmom. So this right here, Jacob and Bilhah and the 11 brothers. So this could be a reference to Bilhah bowing down. But if it refers to Rachel, who has already gone to Sheol, has already lived and gone into the afterlife, that means the living, the patriarchs that are living and the patriarchs that have gone are all going to worship, not worship, but bow down and serve Joseph. So he's definitely taken in his mother and father, but he may be taken in the whole Abrahamic generation, or the whole Abrahamic promise is going to come down to Joseph. So this is, you know, that's what is being said there. What is this dream that you have dreamed? Shall I and your mother and your brothers indeed come and bow ourselves to the ground before you? And his brothers were jealous of him, but his father kept the saying in mind. He finally rebukes Joseph. You've gone too far. I'm creating a monster. But then he says, I mean, this is the same guy who saw, he grew up saying a prophecy, you know, you came out grabbing your brother's heel. He was living under prophecy his whole life. He saw the Lord at the bottom of the stairs with the angels going up and down into heaven. He met God, he wrestled with God, he knows, and when he sees this right here, it's like, what is going on? I see the potential in Joseph. He's now the leader of the brothers, but what does this mean? And he rebuked him. But he didn't forget about it. What is going on? Chapter 37, verse 12. Now his brothers went to pasture the flocks, father's flocks near Shechem. This is, you read your Sunday school story and you just blow right by this. It's just another Bible town, Bethlehem, you know, Israel, Jericho, Shechem, or whatever. Who knows where Shechem's at? You know where Shechem's at. I mean, there's still people there. They killed the men. The governor's son raped Dinah, Shechem was his name. Then they went and slaughtered all the men, and then they took all the women and children as captives, as slaves, and possibly sold them. Now they go to say, well, you've only got so much room in Israel. It's not that big. Israel's not that big of a place. It's about 180 miles this way, about 70 miles wide this way, so there's not a lot of pasture land. Okay, well, let's look at a map. And that's what you have on the next page right there. And this map is important. Here is Hebron. Here's the Sea of Dead Sea, the Jordan River, Galilee. Here's Jerusalem. We'll just put Bethel right here. Here's Shechem up here. Here's the Jabbok River. And then here's this place called Dothan. All right? So this is Hebron. This is Shechem. And this is a new place right here, Dothan. Now, as you can see on that, and this is you know, Abby, you can decide if it's, you know, 50 miles or 51 miles if you want to. But that says 50, right? This is 50 miles here from Hebron. Oops, excuse me. From Hebron to Shechem is 50 miles, and then from Shechem to Dothan is another 13 miles. So, his brothers are up here pasturing the flock by Shechem. Why? I mean, it doesn't tell you. I mean, there's so many things in this story. It's like, well, that's just what they do. It's a Sunday school story. They are up in Shechem. It's like, wait. They left this place. Jacob left this place because he was a stench to the people because he murdered the city. He's like a warlord. Well, now the sons are back up here. Is that where Jacob sent them? Is that where they decided to go? Are they intimidating these people up here? We are going to find out there's a caravan route, if you're still with me. This is the King's Highway. Goes all the way down to Arabia where they get like the spices. They travel all the way up into Aram, up into Assyria. Then they cross right here, a place called Beth Shan, a city, and they cross into the Megiddo Valley. We know the Megiddo Valley, and they travel. Caravans travel across the Megiddo Valley and then turn. Here's the coast right here, and right down here is the coastal plain going down. This is the flat land. This is flat, mountains of Jordan over here, the Rift Valley. So they travel up and down here. Jacob traveled there, Abraham traveled there. They cross the Jordan right here and hit this plain. We've seen pictures of Jezreel and Megiddo looking across and seeing Nazareth up here as the hill climb up into Galilee. So this is a flat plain. The Israeli Air Force is right here. This is Mount Carmel over on this side, and the Mount Carmel mountains trickle down into here, the mountain range kind of trickles down, and they pass through the different passes through Mount Carmel, pick up the coastal plain and go. So Dothan is right here on one of these passes. Why are the boys up here, and why are they up here by Dothan? We don't know. We don't know. But that's a long ways to be away. They're 63 miles away. All right, so I just wanted you to see that. We go back to page 3, chapter 37, verse 12. Now the brothers went to pasture their flock near Shechem, their father's flock. Again, this is Jacob's possessions. They're working for Jacob. Joseph is down here. So clearly Joseph is not pasturing the flock with his brothers because he's 50 miles away. And when he gets here, he's going to have been 65 miles away from where the sheep are being pastured. I'm just giving you information. And Israel said to Joseph, are not your brothers pasturing the flock at Shechem? Meaning I sent them there. I mean, they didn't like break rank and go up there. He goes, I don't know where your brothers are. Go find your brothers. They're somewhere in Canaan. He says, aren't they at Shechem? Come, I will send you to them. And he said to him, here I am. So he said to him, go now, see if it is well with your brothers. He's not sending, remember, they've got servants. It's not 11 boys and a little brother, Ben, and Jacob and all these sheep. They've got people. They've got servants. They're a small nation marching back and forth through here. So Joseph is not being sent. You know, they need a break. They're working so hard, those boys. They probably got servants. Now, what they're all doing up here is they're probably overseeing the pasture. There's got to be, I don't understand, because Reuben's going to go out and check on them here in a minute by himself. So I am confused. They've got servants. They've got people. But these guys are watching the sheep. What are the servants doing? I'm not sure. Go check on your brother. So he wants to know how it's going. And bring me word. Bring me word. That means bring me a report. Go check on your brothers and bring me a report. Before, they've been evil reports. Either moral wickedness in the brother's camp, or Jacob is making stuff up and bringing slander. And you've got to decide, is Joseph slandering his brothers, or is Joseph going and checking on his brothers going, man, you guys, this is not the way to run a business, and going back to dad and saying that they're morally corrupt. It doesn't give you enough information. It does, but it gives you that room to kind of, where's this story going? Okay, so he said to him, go now, see if it is well with your brothers and with the flock, and bring me word. So he sent him from the valley of Hebron, and he came to Shechem. So he makes that 50-mile journey. It's 41 miles from Jerusalem to Shechem. That's 41 miles. So it'd be about 9 miles up to Jerusalem, 41 miles to Shechem. And he gets up there, and they're not there. That's a question mark, okay? They're not there. They're not in the fields. Now remember, has Joseph ever been to Shechem? Yes. He lived here for a while. He came back from Padan Aram. He crossed the Jabbok River. He came over here. He was there, and his brothers slaughtered the city, or Levi and Simeon, at least they did it. But anyway, and he's doesn't know where to go. He's wandering. And a man found him wandering in the fields. And the man asked him, what are you seeking? Now again, this man, just a man. Remember, these were Hivites. These are not Israelites. These are not Ishmaelites. These are not Midianites. These are Canaanites or Hivites that are part of the Canaanites. And if he's around Shechem, he might be the remains. He actually certainly knows the story of what happened to Shechem a few chapters ago. So Joseph is not really in a great position. Is he traveling alone? It seems like he's traveling alone. I would think if he's this mighty in the family, he'd be riding a camel being escorted like with servants. So, I mean, I've got some questions. And the man asked him, what are you seeking? I am seeking my brothers, he said. Tell me, please, where they are pasturing the flock. Well, how would this man know Joseph's brothers? Well, yeah, you may ask that in Sunday school class. How would a man 60 miles away, 50 miles away, know where Joseph's brothers are at? Joseph didn't even introduce himself. Have you seen my brothers? And the guy goes, yes, I have. They're over by Dothan. Everybody knows where your brothers are. I mean, remember, this is Joseph. His family destroyed Shechem. Here's a Hivite still in this area. And Joseph comes back to where his family used to live. The hometown boy comes back. And where are they at? Well, he knows exactly where they're at. I am seeking my brothers. Tell me, please, where they are pasturing the flock. And the man says, they have gone away, for I heard them say. I heard them say, I was in communication with them. Let us go to Dothan. So Joseph went after his brothers and found them at Dothan. Now again, you can see that. This gets interesting for me. And so you've got to hear it. And I've tried to do some maps for you there. Dead Sea, Jordan River, Galilee. Here's the Jabbok. Here's that King's Highway. Here's the Mediterranean Sea. Here's the coastal plain right down here going down to Egypt. Here's their traveling. And now right here is the Megiddo Valley, the Valley of Jezreel, what's going to be called Armageddon. Mount Carmel is here, but Mount Carmel is a mountain range. So this is Mount Carmel, and then it trickles down here. So the caravan would come this way, turn, or in this case, probably come up from Arabia, come here and turn, and then they've got to pass through this mountain range. There are four. We'll just make it simple here. It's on the bet. 1, 2, 3, 4 ways of getting through this mountain range and picking up the coastal plain. And those four, if you want to see them, are right there on the bottom of page 5. They're 1, 2, 3, 4. They are the Yokneam Pass, the Aruna Pass, the Tanakh Pass, and guess what, number 4? The Dothan Pass. And I got that from when Judges 1, we were talking about that. That's a graph. So Dothan is, again, I'm going to move the Jabbok River down here a little bit. There we go. And here is Sechem here, and here's Dothan right here. 1, 2, 3, 4. Okay, don't forget that map. They saw him, verse 18, page 4. They, the brothers, they saw him afar before he came near to them, and they conspired against him to kill him. Again, traveling alone. I don't understand why. But they can see the coat. They recognize him from afar. They're watching the sheep. They can see in a distance. They said to one another, here comes this dreamer. Come now, let us kill him and throw him into one of the pits or cisterns. And these cisterns would be holes in the ground where they would collect water. Water would run off, and they'd be like a bottleneck, narrow bottleneck, like a shaft. But then it'd bowl out into a big area, and then they'd plaster it. Now, these boys probably didn't make it themselves, but there's somewhere around Dothan here, there's a cistern. And there'd be several cisterns, and they'd build them so that water, you could see different places, I could go into some detail here, but when water would rain, there's only get like 24 to 28 inches of rain, I got it written down there, and then a year, and so when it did rain, it would run off and go into the cistern, and it'd be plaster on the inside so they could maintain it, and then they could care for like about 2.5 acres of runoff water, 2.5 acres of runoff water could water a flock of 5,000 sheep for a year. And so, and that's what a cistern is. So they said to him, they said to one another, here comes this dreamer, let us kill him and throw him into one of the pits. So what they're going to do, they're going to kill him and then he's dead, throw the body down the shaft into the bottom of one of these cisterns in the water, and no one will ever find him. No one will ever find him. And then they can go tell their dad, no, we didn't see him. And then his dad's going to have to come to a conclusion. Come now, let us kill him. Then we will say that a fierce animal has devoured him, and we will see what will become of his dreams. Those dreams, we're going to end those dreams right now. And then who's going to fulfill them? But now here, the oldest son, but when Reuben heard it, he rescued him out of their hands, saying, no, let us not take his life. And Reuben said to them, shed no blood, which is a good point. I'll read some things for you. Throw him into the pit here in the wilderness, but do not lay a hand on him. For he might, okay, and then it says, that he might rescue him out of their hands to restore him to their father. So Reuben fully intends to rescue him, bring him back to his father. Look what I did. I bring a negative report about my brothers also. Me and Joseph are on your side. He's trying to get on the winning team, it appears. Their idea, they're going to go with it, and here it is, it says right here, when Joseph came to his brothers, they stripped him of his robe, the robe of many colors that he wore, Why did they not keep? Why did they just throw it in the pit with it? And they took him and threw him into the pit. And here's, it says two things here. The pit was empty. There was no water in it. Well, obviously, if the pit is empty, there's no water in it. Why repeat it? Well, it's empty. He's alone, and there's no water in it. He's going to die of thirst. There's no way of staying alive. He's abandoned alone in the pit. There's no water in the pit. It was empty. There's no water. And that's why it's restated. There's a couple pictures of some tops of cisterns that I took pictures of in Israel. So you can imagine what's down below. There's the shaft. And then you just cover it up with a stone. Now again, Reuben wants to come rescue him and set him free. The brothers are not going to kill him. They're going to just let him suffer and die alone in the pit. Personally, I'd rather just decapitate me and get it over with. Don't let me just die in a pit. There's something about bloodshed coming up here, and I've got some notes on that. Okay, it goes on. Then they set down to eat. Verse 23. So when Joseph came to his brothers, they stripped him. Okay, I read that. And the pit was empty. There's no water. So they throw him in the pit, and they sit down to eat, kind of showing their callousness. And looking up, they saw a caravan of Ishmaelites coming from Gilead. Now, you know where Gilead's at. This is Gilead. Now, they're coming from Gilead. Well, they're probably coming up from Arabia and going to cross and go to Egypt. Or they could be coming down, but more likely they're coming up and going across. They're gathering material. They're coming from Gilead. This says Ishmaelites. They're going to be called, and some people go freaky on this, because they're pretty soon going to be called Midianites. And I'll explain that here in a moment. Coming from Gilead, with their camels bearing gum, balm, and myrrh on their way. The myrrh and the spices come from Arabia, so it's going to be coming up this way. The balm, you've heard the balm of Gilead, that's in this area. So they're bringing this stuff up here, mixing it with this stuff, and heading on to Egypt to sell it. That's what's going to take place. And if you notice right there, there's those four passes, 1, 2, 3, 4 passes, and one of them is Dothan. So they're going to come down this way, and then they could turn 1, 2, 3, 4 ways of going through. Militaries use this all the time. King Thutmose III used these to fight the battles here at Megiddo. But they're going to come here and take the first left, go past Dothan, get through the mountain range of the Carmel Mountains, and head down to Egypt. And this is where the brothers are right here. Now, why are they here and not here? Because they ran out of pasture land, or they're over here trading and doing deals? I don't know. They sit down to eat. They're on their way to carry down to Egypt. Then Judah said to his brothers, now Judah's going to step in and try and save him. What profit is it if we kill our brothers? Now, Judah does not know Reuben's plan to rescue him out of the pit and take him home. Judah's just trying to save his brothers somehow and say he don't want any more guilt. What profit is it if we kill our brother and conceal his blood? You don't want to conceal the blood. That's a big phrase. Come, let us sell him to the Ishmaelites, and let not our hand be upon him, for he is our brother, our own flesh. And his brothers listened to him. The Midianite traders passed by. All of a sudden, I say, oh, look, this is a fault. The Midianite traders passed by. So the Ishmaelites, and now they pass by, they're Midianites. Traders passed by. I'll show you that in a minute. And they drew Joseph up and lifted him out of the pit and sold him to the Ishmaelites for 20 shekels of silver. They took Joseph to Egypt. Now, first of all, go to the next page. Many of these things I've said, but look at point 3. Ishmaelites and Midianites. Ishmaelites are related to Abraham through his wife Hagar. Midianites related to Abraham through his wife Keturah. So they're both descendants. They're like the sons of Isaac, or the sons of Ishmael, or the sons of Keturah. That's what they are. These people were uncles to Jacob. These are Jacob's uncles, or they're the brothers that are selling Joseph. They're second or third cousins to Joseph and his brothers. Both Ishmaelites and Midianites were traders from Arabian desert. The two terms Ishmaelite and Midianites can be used to refer to the same group of people. They're synonyms. You can say that. That's true. Ishmaelites and Midianites are exchangeable, but you can push it further. But point F, both terms can refer to separate people groups. There are Midianites and there are Ishmaelites. They come from two different wives through Abraham. The Midianites, and this is what it is, point F1 and F2, Midianites are the negotiators and buyers for the products coming from the Ishmaelites. So the Ishmaelites are going to be down here in Arabia picking up and trading for the spices and the myrrh. And they're going to take that. They're like the businessmen that get the product. And then they transfer it to the Ishmaelites, who are the middlemen, who are going to be the ones who sell it. These guys are going to run the truck routes up here to the warehouse. The warehouse is going to take it and then distribute it. So you've got Ishmaelites coming up this way, meeting up with the Midianites in this area, who are adding their balm to the caravan. And then it's an Ishmaelite caravan run by the Midianite trucking company, if you want to say it that way. It's ingenious. It gives insight into what's taking place here. And I've got more information written down there. And they paid 20 shekels of silver for Joseph. Now, what's interesting about that, look at that top chart right there on page 6. You can see right there where they come up the Midian Valley and they take the Dothan Pass, that dotted line coming on the map on the right side and coming off the bottom of the map. That's the route they could have taken. They could take three others, but they took that one. The 20 shekels of silver, that matches the research that they have done. I've got a chart on page 7. This is the year, 1890 right here. It's between 1800 and 1900 right in here. And if you look right there, right around 1800, 1700, 20 shekels was the price of a slave. And I've got information right there. By the time it gets to 1400 BC, when the law of Moses is being written, between 1500 and 1300, it's 30 shekels of silver. In Exodus 21:32, a slave is 30 shekels of silver, which matches the Nuzi and the Ugarit tablets from 1400 BC, where a slave is sold for 30 shekels of silver. So if we go through, and I could go through and give you all the details here, but in 2100 BC, a slave is, in ancient documents, is 10 shekels. At this time, they're 20 shekels, or between 1800 and 1700, they're 20 shekels. Between Moses' day, they're 30 shekels. Then you get to the time of the judges and up through David time, 40 shekels. In David's day, they jump to about 50 shekels. This is in the ancient Middle East. Persian period, they're 80 shekels. 300 BC, they're 100 shekels. And by the time Rome comes around, it's 125 Tyre silver shekels, 125 for a slave. Now there's a prophecy that will make sense to you now. Zechariah chapter 11 verse 13 names the price the Messiah will be sold for. And it says this right here. I don't have it written out here. But it says, 30 pieces of silver is the handsome price they paid for me. And that is what they sold. Judas took 30 pieces of silver for Jesus. A slave at that time went for 125. He sold him at the price of 1900 BC. 30 shekels of did I say that right? What did I say? Yeah, 30 pieces of silver. Nonetheless, when he says handsome price that he paid, that is that's a mockery. It's like that's all they paid for him. It was a low price. Okay, anyway, when Reuben returned to the pit and saw that Joseph was not in the pit, he tore his clothes and returned to his brothers and says, "The boy is gone, and now where shall I go?" In other words, that was my ticket back with my father. Now he's gone. Then they took Joseph's robe, slaughtered a goat, and dipped it in the robe in the blood, and they sent the robe of many colors, that's the second time it says that, and brought it to their third time, through their father, and says, "This we have found." Now notice what they do. They don't tell him what happened. They don't build a whole story. They simply provide him with a bloody garment. "This is what we found." They say, "And this is we have found. Please identify whether it is your son's robe or not. We know you gave one like yours." Now again, if it's unique, it has to be your son's. But if it's a typical cultural thing where you give the heir of the estate or the leader this robe, here's some royal leader's robe. Is this the one you gave Joseph? It could be somebody else's, but it's somebody's administrator's robe. And he identified it and says, "It is my son's robe." And then he says himself, "A fierce animal has devoured him. Joseph is without doubt torn to pieces." And there's a little word of advice if you want to put that in Proverbs or worldly wisdom. Don't provide them a story. Provide evidence and let them make up the story themselves. And now they're not going to argue with their own story. If you tell them a story, they'll argue with it. If you let them make up the story, it's like, "Oh, yeah, that's what happened." And he goes to his grave, he thinks, believing that story. No one's going to argue with him. Again, notice that Jacob deceived his father with the goat skin, and now he gets deceived with goat blood. Then Jacob tore his garments and put on sackcloth on his loins and mourned for his son many days. 7 days is normal. Many days might be years. All his sons and all of his daughters rose up to comfort him. And again, daughters is plural. There's more than Dinah. Does that mean he's got more daughters? Does that mean they're the daughter-in-laws? Tried to comfort him, but he refused to be comforted and says, no, it's over. I shall go down to Sheol to my son mourning. Now, that's interesting. There's a little bit of insight into Jacob's afterlife understanding. I shall go down to Sheol to my son mourning. No talk of heaven, no talk of resurrection. It's just go down to the underworld, and I'll live forever in the underworld with my son in the underworld. And there's a truth there. Jesus went into Sheol, but he delivered Sheol from death. Thus his father wept for him, and that's the same sentence that this sentence, end of 34 or 35, goes right into verse 36, and you end up with two things. You end up with, it says, Jacob weeping and Joseph in Egypt. And that's how it ends. This story ends. Jacob weeping, Joseph's in Egypt. He thinks it's over, but wait, Joseph's in Egypt. And the story continues. And so it says, meanwhile, the Midianites, see, the Ishmaelites started the caravan. The Midianites sold them in Egypt to Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh, the captain of the guard. So he's the captain of the secret security for Potiphar. And that's where Joseph's at. And we'll pick that up next week. Many things we could add to that, but again, that's enough. I'll pray. If you have any questions or comments, please feel free. Father, do thank you for the chance to look into these things. We thank you for your word. We ask that we would ourselves would honor you, that we would serve you, that we would not manipulate, but we would trust your guidance. We do thank you for bringing us to the place that we are, and ask that we may, just like each people, the people in this story, if it's Reuben or a Joseph or Jacob himself, that they would grow closer to you and they'd purify their own lives. And we think that we have the Spirit of God and the Word of God helping us live holy lives, leading and guiding us. And we ask that we would mature in our faith and in our Christian life. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Thank you for being here.